loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we talk about the G20 summit in Argentina over the weekend. We're going to focus on the meetings between President Donald Trump and the Chinese President Xi Jinping, who declared a truce in the U.S.-China trade war. We're going to talk about what that means going forward. And then it's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, former President George H.W. Bush died over the weekend at the age of 94. His body will lie in state in the U.S. Capitol, and a funeral will take place on Wednesday. We'll look at the Bush presidency and the Bush legacy each day this week, focusing on a different issue. Today, we'll talk about the invasion of Panama. Next, rioting across France continued to spread over the weekend, with students blockading more than 100 high schools to protest changes in the country's university entrance system. Protesters also blockaded 11 fuel depots in northern France, causing severe gas shortages. But polls show that 72% of French adults support the protests, and they show no sign of waning. Then today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And then three St. Louis police officers who beat an undercover colleague during a protest last year turned themselves in after being indicted on federal charges. A fourth also was indicted for lying to a grand jury about the incident. And finally, the far-right Vox Party stunned Spain this weekend by winning seats in the Andalusian regional parliament. The party won 12 seats and 11% of the vote on a platform of expelling all immigrants from Spain and ending Catalonia's political autonomy. And in other headlines, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador was sworn in on Saturday as former President Enrique Peña Nieto left power. López Obrador focused much of his campaign on corruption and reorienting Mexico's government and economy in a progressive direction. He strongly denounced past neoliberal policies, saying during his inauguration speech, quote, "Neoliberalism is corruption. It sounds strong, but privatization in Mexico has meant corruption," unquote. Former FBI Director James Comey will testify privately in front of the House Judiciary and House Oversight Committees about the investigation into Hillary Clinton's private email servers and any possible collusion between President Trump's campaign and the Russian government. The transcript of the testimony will be released 24 hours later. The Energy Minister of Qatar has announced that his country will be withdrawing from OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, next month. OPEC controls a large share of global petroleum production and sets production caps and targets to regulate prices. Qatar cited its desire to dramatically ramp up natural gas production as the reason for its withdrawal. President Trump took to Twitter today to weigh in on several cases related to the Mueller investigation. Trump praised Roger Stone for his refusal to testify against him, calling Mueller, quote, "a rogue and out of control prosecutor," unquote. In another tweet, Trump expressed outrage that Michael Cohen, his former personal attorney, is attempting to avoid jail time, saying that the prosecutor should throw the book at him. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the G20 and, most importantly, the outcome of the meeting between President Donald Trump and the Chinese President Xi Jinping. The Group of 20 or G20 summit is over. As summits go, it was pretty uneventful, almost not newsworthy. President Trump and the leaders of Canada and Mexico announced a trade deal to replace NAFTA. But the most important part of the weekend was the meeting between the Chinese president and the U.S. president. President Trump announced that he would not boost tariffs on Chinese goods on January 1st, and that China would purchase what he called a very substantial amount of U.S. agricultural, industrial, and energy products, and would reduce or remove tariffs on U.S. automobiles. Is this a truce in the U.S.-China trade war, Or was it something else? We're joined from London by John Ross, senior fellow at Chungnyang Institute, Renmin University of China. He is also an award-winning resident columnist with several Chinese media organizations. John Ross, welcome back.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. Anyway, big news, of course, in the American media, perhaps the top news, outside of the upcoming funeral of George H.W. Bush. Certainly big news in China. President Xi Jinping, Donald Trump, they met, they declared a 90-day truce. Is it a truce or is it the end of this trade war?
It's not quite the way I would pose it about the trade war. It's not necessarily a truce. It's a situation during which the two sides are going to negotiate. I think the United States made some serious miscalculations because, bluntly, it's rather ill-informed about China. There was a very good comment which was put up on Twitter looking at the dinner table at the meeting between Xi and Trump, which said that nobody on the American side had any expertise or serious understanding of China at all. And therefore, there had been an estimate by the U.S. that, you know, you would impose some tariffs and therefore China would immediately, the economy would collapse or something. And this turned out to be totally false, as any expert on China would know. Therefore, Trump's administration found that the situation with China was not at all what it expected because China hit back rather hard. And now I think it gives it time to think for the Trump administration. And China has always been clear that it doesn't want a trade war with the U.S. I think it's absolutely accurate. It's a lose-lose situation. I mean, American soybean farmers, manufacturers lose. I mean, the Ford Motor Company, General Motors say they're going to lose $1 billion as a result of the tariffs. On the other hand, it also creates problems for China. It's genuinely a lose-lose. So it would be better to get into a situation in which the two negotiated about the situation. That's what I think. Hopefully, it won't be the resumption, therefore, of the trade war.
John Ross is our guest. We're talking to John from London. John Kiriakou and John Ross, I want to read a tweet from, guess who?
Oh, this will be good.
Donald Trump. It was Monday. That's today. Quote, farmers will be a very big, and big is all caps, and fast, all caps, beneficiary of our deal with China. They intend to start purchasing agricultural products immediately. We make the finest and cleanest product in the world, and that is what China wants. Farmers, I love you, all caps. Yeah. So, John, the reason China stopped buying American agricultural products, or at least to the extent that they had been, was not because of what China did, but because of their response to what Donald Trump did. So as much as Donald Trump says he loves farmers and they will be a very big, big beneficiary, if anything, this would just go back to the status quo that existed before Trump's hostile position towards China.
Remember, the Chinese have been reactive in all of this. This was not a Chinese initiative. This was an American initiative.
American farmers will be the big beneficiaries, John Ross.
Well, they're not going to be beneficiaries. They're merely going to be saved from a big mess because the soybean prices in the U.S. have fallen extremely severely because of the tariffs which Trump imposed, which necessarily China responded to. So it's not the question that farmers are a big beneficiary. What it is farmers have taken an extremely big negative hit due to Trump's tariff policies. And he's now trying to at least get them something out of this mess. What existed previously was a real example of a win-win. Although China wants to be sort of self-sufficient in the most fundamental things such as grain, wheat, and so on, it doesn't believe that it can expand its soybean production to meet all its domestic needs, and therefore it's the world's largest importer of soybeans. It was very happy if America can produce soy, which America has very efficient farming, if it can produce soybeans, China, it's in the interest of China to purchase them. It was Trump who disrupted that. There was a very win-win relationship, therefore, between China and American farmers, and Trump messed it up. And therefore, for him to claim, you know, this great big deal is actually the American farmers were doing very well, and he created a big problem for them. Now he's wants to get out of this mess. I mean, my guess is that he wants to get out of this mess because the midterm elections went rather badly for him. The Democrats, you know, were ahead in the popular vote by 7% in the midterm elections. That threatens his position for the 2020 presidential election. He doesn't like this situation. And therefore, having created a big mess, he wants to extricate himself from it. But it's not he's created a big win. He's just merely trying to reduce the negative effects of what he previously did.
John Ross, I want to read to you from an official White House press statement after the dinner between Xi Jinping and Donald Trump and what the spin that the White House is putting on it. The President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, and President Xi Jinping of China have just concluded what both said was a, quote, highly successful meeting, close quote, between themselves and their most senior representatives in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Very importantly, President Xi, in a wonderful humanitarian gesture, has agreed to designate fentanyl as a controlled substance. Okay. Second, next paragraph. On trade, President Trump has agreed that on January 1st, 2019, he will leave the tariffs on $200 billion worth of product at the 10% rate and not raise it to 25% at this time. China will agree to purchase a not yet agreed upon but very substantial amount of agricultural, energy, industrial, and other products from the United States to reduce the trade imbalances between our two countries. China has agreed to start purchasing agricultural products from our farmers immediately. And then President Trump and President Xi have agreed to immediately begin negotiations on structural changes with respect to forced technology transfer, intellectual property protection, non-tariff barriers, cyber intrusions and cyber theft, services and agriculture. I want to talk about that. What does this actually mean? This is the White House statement. It's not a joint statement. Substantial negotiations on structural changes with respect to forced technology transfers. What does the White House mean, and what has China, if anything, given the White House?
Well, I think there's a number of different things there. I think on the question of intellectual property protection, the situation could be better in China. I mean, I know that, you know, because I lived there for a lot of the time, you know, you can walk around and buy, you know, latest version of Windows Office or something, you know, for $10 because somebody's pirated it, right? You know, I'm all in favor of clamping down on that type of thing. That's not in anybody's interest. And there are some definite improvements that could be made. Forced technological transfer, in my opinion, is a totally pseudo category, because what it really means is, you know, American companies want to set up joint ventures and other things in China because China is, well, actually, in real terms, China is the biggest market in the world, because although the dollar exchange rate, China's the second biggest economy in the world, in what economists call parity purchasing powers, which is equivalent prices, China's actually the biggest economy in the world. Therefore, American companies want to get into China because of the huge potential there. And the Chinese companies say, that's fine, we can do a deal with you, et cetera, but we would like, you know, we'd like to get some technology, et cetera. And American companies think, that's great. Okay, we, you know, we gain $100 million through the trade. We lose $20 million through the technology transfer. You know, that's a good deal. It's not forced technology transfer. Nobody can force an American company to enter China. The American companies will do rational calculations on what they gain and what they lose. So, you know, there's several different things in there, some things that could be sorted out. And some things which are just sort of pseudo attacks carried out by, you know, Trump with, you know, a lot of rhetoric, which doesn't mean much.
John Ross, help our audience understand the relative significance of China's private sector, the privately owned corporations and the state-owned sectors, and the relationship of the privately owned sector to the Chinese state. I think the monopoly on foreign trade has been officially ended, meaning that in the past, Chinese enterprises doing business with Western or non-Chinese enterprises would have to go through a state approval process. But how much significance does the Chinese state still leverage over private companies, or are they free to do what they want to do?
Well, yeah, certainly the state monopoly on foreign trade was abolished several decades ago. That's irrelevant. The key factor in China is if you look at creation of jobs, almost entirely comes from the private sector, about 90%. If you look at investment, it's about 60% in the private sector and about 40% in the state sector. But you've got to look at what Trump's saying. Trump is actually admitting that China has a superior economic system to the US. What is his actual claim? His claim is that China is gaining an unfair advantage by all the state investment in the economy. Well, but according to his other propaganda, you know, the private sector is necessarily more productive. And therefore, actually, if he took his rhetoric seriously, China, all this state intervention would be a disadvantage for China. So actually, in a sort of backhanded comment, he's admitting that China's economy is actually more efficient than the question of the US. Or what the real situation is the majority of jobs and the majority of investment is created by the private sector in China, which is entirely free to do trade with the US. But the state sector is used to boost certain parts of the economy, to make sure that there is a sort of technological breakthroughs and so on. And indeed, however, incidentally, there's a very strange feature of this, which is, on the one hand, Trump wants to say that China is going to agree to very large amounts of imports from U.S. agricultural producers and others. But the only actual way that China can do that is for the state to take the decision, because it's clear that left to purely market forces, the Chinese private sector won't actually import these things. So therefore, won't import them to the level that Trump wants. To make the increase, China's going to have to take state action. Therefore, all Trump's claims that the Chinese state is inefficient, etc., actually is relying upon the Chinese state to carry out the agreement that was made.
The Chinese seem to have muted the language of China 2025, a project whereby China was announcing its own sort of emergence into another stage as a world player in the world economy. That's been a target of James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, other Trump officials, John Bolton in particular, and Mike Pompeo, who have argued that it's really China trying to, quote, take over and not win-win, but push America to the side. The Chinese at least seem to have muted the rhetoric somewhat about that. Is that partly just a cosmetic political concession?
Well, this attack by the United States is completely ridiculous. All sorts of countries have policies for pushing forward their technological level. I mean, Germany has one very openly. The European Union has one. If the US doesn't want to have one, that's creating a problem for the US. But there's nothing unusual about what China is doing. Also, China is not attempting to push the US companies aside. But to be blunt, China doesn't have the ability, even if it wanted to, which it doesn't, to push US companies aside. The per capita GDP of China, which is in line with its technological level, is, about a third of the level of the US. And therefore, in certain very high technology sectors, the US will continue to have a lead for several decades. All that China wants to do is to make sure it's going from low value-added, or it's actually left low value-added behind some time ago, and it's in sort of medium value-added technologies, and it wants to get into higher ones. That's all. It's a perfectly normal process. China wants to go from about 33% of the per capita GDP of the US to, 50% in the foreseeable future and to go on. So all this, China is not attempting to push anything out of the way at all. I mean, the whole feature of Trump is that he actually can't accelerate the US economy. The factual things are, contrary to all this great rhetoric about how fast the US economy is growing, peak growth, GDP growth under Trump is the slowest under any American president since World War II. So instead of doing what he should be doing, which is concentrating on speeding up the US economy, which is nobody could stop him doing and would be absolutely fine. Instead, what he wants to be doing is slowing down the Chinese economy. But that's due to the fact that the US economy is not really growing tremendously fast in this situation. But that means, if you want to slow down China, that means the Chinese people should remain at a much lower standard of living than the American people, and they're not going to accept that. And I can also assure you, in 20 years' time, India is not going to accept it either.
Yeah. I read to you, John Ross, a little bit of the White House statement, the official statement. Here's President Trump coming back aboard Air Force One right after the meeting. I want to read a couple sentences to you from that and then get your opinion. It's been really something, that's Trump speaking. You may also want to say that the president has agreed that if the Qualcomm deal that they rejected, which was one of the larger deals of its kind, which China rejected, if that deal came back to him, he would most likely approve it quickly, which is a big thing. Coming back to him, of course, is a reference to President Xi Jinping. Qualcomm just announced, John Ross, that they have no interest in pursuing the deal, that the deadline has passed. Just give us a quick kind of brief update about what this is all about.
This is a typical of Trump. He takes some small, relatively small matter and blows it up. The Qualcomm question was not a big deal. It was a deal, but it's involved in about $44 billion, which is frankly, in terms of relations between the China and the United States, not a really big deal. It's a question of if Qualcomm has no interest in revisiting the matter, that's their commercial consideration. That shows it's even more it's not a big deal. It was never a big deal in the first place. And if Qualcomm is not interested, it's even less of a big deal.
At the meeting between Xi Jinping and Donald Trump, they also talked about North Korea. Trump talked about that on both in the White House press statement and also in his remarks to the media aboard Air Force One. And he announced that both countries were going to work together on the denuclearization of the entire Korean Peninsula. He also announced that in this meeting with the media aboard Air Force One, that he's expecting another summit with Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea. Does it appear to you that the U.S. and China are actually working together? Or let's put it more precisely, that Donald Trump and China are working together to come up with some sort of new stage in U.S.-Korean relations?
Well, no, I think this distinction between the denuclearization of North Korea and the denuclearization of the whole Korean Peninsula is a very significant difference in terminology. If you put it as the denuclearization of North Korea, what that really means is that the North Korea can be put under pressure of the U.S. and threatened militarily. And frankly, I think personally, I'm not giving the position of China on this, my personal view is North Korea is highly unlikely to give up nuclear weapons under those circumstances because it doesn't have any security guarantees. Once you pose the situation as the denuclearization of the whole Korean Peninsula, what that really means is there's not a military threat to North Korea and there's not a military threat to South Korea. And therefore, the two countries can proceed to do what they're doing at the present time, which is they're trying to create a better relationship between the two. So I think this action, the difference in terminology is rather significant. China has made its positions known very clearly. It's in favor of the denuclearization of the whole of the Korean Peninsula, which must include, therefore, both security guarantees for both North Korea and South Korea. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable position.
John Ross is our guest. We're talking about the meeting between President Donald Trump and President Xi Jinping of China at the G20 meeting in Buenos Aires, Argentina. John, let's go in our last couple of minutes. I'd like you to help the audience, as an expert on China, to help the audience understand what China's international policies, its foreign policy, and its international economic policies. What are the main objectives right now? We see there's the One Belt, One Road. There's a lot of talk about China's continued and expanding engagement with Africa. President Xi Jinping just stopped in Panama, which had been basically a U.S. colony for 100 years, just stopped there at the end of the G20. Talk about China's economic goals in terms of its international policy. And very quickly, if you could help the audience understand, is this similar to or different from, say, U.S. economic engagement with other countries, say, in Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, Asia? Go ahead.
Yeah, there is a fundamental difference. China's policy is expressed in the Chinese terminology by President Xi Jinping as a community of human destiny, by which what it means is that there's a common future for humanity. Put it in economic terms, it's win-win outcome. This is not merely nice terminology. Now, the founding work of economics was Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, of which the first sentence and the key to the whole thing is that the most powerful force in the development of production and productivity is the division of labor. That means in the modern world that it's international division of labor. Therefore, win-win outcome is not merely nice terminology, but it's real. China cannot produce soybeans as effectively as the United States, or as cheaply as the United States. On the other hand, the United States cannot match China's ability to produce, you know, medium technology manufacturing goods. Therefore, the sensible thing to do is for China to be exchanging its manufacturing products for American soybeans or for Boeing aircraft, if you want to take another part of the technological spectrum. And both countries would lose if they attempted to produce these things themselves. Therefore, not merely are there common international questions such as climate change or the fight against terrorism and things like that, but simply the international division of labor is to the benefit of all countries. Therefore, China's perspective is win-win outcome, which is practical and real, and Trump's is America first, which sees the situation as a war between, you know, I don't mean a literal military war, but a conflict between various countries. Yeah, so there's a fundamental difference, and China's perspectives is more, not merely more in the interest of China, it's more in the interest of other countries than is Trump's America first.
30 seconds left, John Ross, or 45 seconds to be precise. The Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, has been on the warpath, rhetorically at least, against China, against China's position in the South China Sea. The U.S. has reoriented its own foreign policy and military policy with the new national security strategy, preparing for major power conflict. What's the big picture here? Is this just posturing, an excuse for more military spending, or can you envision a real conflict?
It's just a load of troublemaking. Nobody else in the South China Sea wants a conflict. See, if you see that, the relations between Philippines and China have become excellent. They've agreed upon joint economic exploitation in the South China Sea. Indonesia doesn't want a conflict. None of the countries in the South China Sea want a conflict. They want to get on with growing rapidly. The economic potential of the South China Sea, according to the IMF, is bigger than the G7. They want quiet and get with economic development. Therefore, they're not going to accept all this troublemaking from the outside because they don't want a crisis.
That was John Ross. We talked to John from London. John Ross is the senior fellow at Chungyang Institute, Renmin University of China. He is an award-winning resident columnist with several Chinese media organizations. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, welcome back.
Good to talk to you guys again. We made it to another week.
That's a low bar. we should have higher expectations. But let's start with the military-industrial complex, and you named it Microsoft.
That's right. There are two big Microsoft stories coming out this last week. So first, we thought this one was big, right? Microsoft said that they had been granted a $480 million contract with the U.S. Army to develop this visor HoloLens technology. This is like goggles, or it's a visor that you put on your head. And they say specifically that it needs to be small and light, so it won't even be mounted on a helmet. This thing has a 3D screen, cameras, hearing protection, and get this, it's got a ballistic laser built in. The stated purpose of the contract is to increase, quote, lethality, mobility, and situational awareness for the troops. Microsoft is literally going to make $480 million, at least, to increase the lethality of the U.S. military. Now, they're going to start with 2,500 of these, and then they're going to increase to 100,000 at first, which sort of makes sense, right? the military has been shifting towards using more drones and more airstrikes rather than full-scale troop deployments right now. But it also has a focus on elite special ops teams that are out in the field. Right now, there's, as far as we know, about 400,000 are overseas in countries like Ukraine, Pakistan, and Syria.
Yemen. Let's not forget Yemen. They're the ones calling in the bombing strikes, like the ones on the school bus.
Yes, and also Somalia as well. But at the same time, the Pentagon is also preparing for the possibility of a major powers conflict, and that would almost necessitate a mass deployment of troops. And I can only imagine that they're going to be increasing the orders at well past 100,000 after they test this. And again, we have to just repeat this. The stated purpose of the contract is to increase lethality of the troops.
Yeah, this is not technology that is going to beam sound waves so that you can still win on the battlefield and not permanently injure anybody. This is specifically to kill more people.
Which is the function of most military organizations. I mean, it's inherent and foundational in a way. But, you know, it's when you look at this thing, the HoloLens, it's pretty eerie. Called Integrated Visual Augmentation System, IVUS, formerly Heads Up Display, HUD 3.0. The goal of the project is to develop the headset that gives soldiers, as Chris Garofa says, both in training and combat, an increase in lethality, mobility, and situational awareness. The system should provide remote viewing of weapon sites to enable low-risk, rapid target acquisition, perform automated or assisted target acquisition. What is target acquisition, John?
Target acquisition is when you have your intended target in your sights and you're ready to launch.
Right. So it's like we're about to kill you.
It's kill time.
It's kill yes. time. It will integrate both thermal and night vision cameras. What's that? Let's talk. They sound sort of the dystopian future is here. What does that mean? What are thermal and night vision cameras?
A thermal camera sees heat instead of, you know, standard light. So you can see if there's a body in complete darkness or even, you know, in some cases behind a wall. A night vision camera just, you know, enhances vision at night, lets you see in almost complete darkness. So this is really, really telling about where the military is going to be going in terms of its technological development. And we should say the Microsoft HoloLens was first. It's a consumer product. This started as a consumer product a couple years ago, and you know you could do cute things with augmented reality. You know, you put an image of a cat that looks like it's real on your couch, and that was one of the demos that they did. This started as a consumer technology, and of course, Microsoft was, I'm sure, thinking about the military application as part of its ongoing work with the military. But also, the military has been looking at things like this, and we know they have had projects that they've tried to develop in the past as well.
Microsoft is one of the biggest companies in the country and in the world. Amazon, another one. Google, another one. These are the big tech giants, right? What starts as a civilian product ends up as a military product. And also in technology, Chris, what starts as a military project or product ends up as a civilian product. This was certainly true. Take the nuclear industry. It started as nuclear weapons. Then it morphed into a form of subsidy for corporations to build nuclear energy and nuclear power plants. But it shows how in our society, the complete 100% integration of the military and militarism as a system is with the rest of the economy, including the production of consumer goods. Talk about that.
That's right. I mean, we should even look at the fact that the internet itself was a military, basically a military development. The technologies that made the basis of the internet were developed by ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is sort of a military adjacent research agency of the U.S. government. Now, imagine, though, if IBM, for example, as a private profit-driven company, had developed the internet rather than ARPA. It certainly wouldn't be where we are today. But to your point, Brian, yes, there is so much transfer between the private industry and the U.S. military, and it's such a large portion of contracts for companies like Microsoft, but also obviously for Raytheon and Boeing, and many sectors of the industry, not just the tech world.
Yeah, and Amazon also has big defense contracts. I think it was a $10 billion defense contract that I don't think they've landed it yet, but they will. They have a $600 million contract using Amazon Web Services with the CIA. It's the national surveillance state merged with corporate domination. And when I'm talking about corporate domination, I'm talking about really mega monopolies, because there's a very, very, very few of them.
That's right. And I think this is a good time to talk about our second Microsoft story as well. Over the weekend, I thought nothing could top that first story from Microsoft. Over the weekend, though, Microsoft's Brad Smith, their president and chief legal officer, was speaking at a military forum and said, quote, said the company is, quote, going to provide the U.S. military with access to the best technology, all the technology we create, full stop. That is
chilling.
Yeah. Yeah, John, exactly. Jeez. This is Microsoft saying that they're going to go far, above and beyond this $480 million contract and whatever other contracts they already have with their Azure hosting systems and their all of the stuff that they do for the military. They develop special versions of Windows for the U.S. government and for the military that are more locked down. Same thing with other devices that they make. They're going to just give the military, I don't want to say they're going to give it, because they're going to make money off of this, but they're going to give access to all of these technologies directly to the U.S. military. So the other thing I'm thinking here is, like, Microsoft has learned nothing from recent developments at like Salesforce and Google and Amazon. They've learned almost nothing from this. And really, Smith's comments were actually very offensive. He played lip service to the concerns by his employees. He knows that employees are concerned about these developments. And he even cites an email from a Microsoft employee who grew up in Serbia. And Serbia, of course, was bombed by the U.S. in the late 90s. And Smith says he understands why this employee would be upset. But of course, he didn't mention any changes.
Chris, I think the reason that Brad Smith, the CEO or the president of Microsoft, the reason he said this at this Reagan National Defense Forum at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California, I think the reason he said this, we're going to, quote, as you put it, provide the U.S. military with access to the best technology, all the technology we create, full stop. That's the end of his quote. The reason he said that is he's telling the Pentagon, look, yeah, we have these idealistic employees, these employees who we've allowed to, sort of sound off in opposition to using their skills and their talents for the purpose of the military machine. We know that they exist, he's sort of telling the Pentagon, but guess what? They don't matter. They don't matter because we're going on the record right now, not saying that we're going to bid for and compete with others for contracts. We, Microsoft, are so loyal to you, the Pentagon. We're so prepared to genuflect and bow at the altar of military spending that we're telling you in advance that we will give you everything that you possibly need.
And therefore, it's no wonder that Microsoft passed Apple last week as the largest company in the world.
Yeah, that's because there's capitalism. There's the free market capitalism of yesteryear. Then there was kind of the imperialist capitalism that began by the end of the 19th century, where the entire world was divided up into colonies. But now we're in this other stage of capitalism, which is the complete 100% fusion with militarism and the military machine, in spite of the fact that the Cold War had ended 27 years ago. There was no global power menacing the United States, which pretextually was used as the justification for all this military spending. In spite of that, military spending is going through the roof, and the merger between the leading centers of capital and the military machine, that's expanding, it's not diminishing.
Yes, absolutely. And this is the natural outgrowth, I think, as you're getting at, of the military-industrial complex, this partnership between the public sector and the private industry. It's the necessity of growth at any cost in order to put profit at the very forefront of anything that happens on both sides of that.
All right. Let's go on to another story, Chris Garaffa.
Okay, so in the past week, there has been a major federal lawsuit filed by the EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation, the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, and others. This goes back to something that we found out about in August. We found out that the government had tried to force Facebook to break the encryption on its Facebook Messenger product, and the government had filed this in federal court. Doing that would have allowed the Department of Justice to get the content of the messages that people were sending on Facebook. So the specific case this was around an investigation of some alleged MS-13 gang members, but we know that, you know, that gang has a minimal presence in the U.S., but it's been a huge talking point of the Trump administration. It's part of its anti-immigrant bigotry. It appears that the court ruled that Facebook didn't have to do this based on some news reports that came out in Reuters in September. And that's potentially good news for people's privacy. But the problem is the case is still under seal, meaning that there's no legal filings in it that are available to the public. We can't see any of the arguments or any of the decisions. So what this lawsuit is, from the EFF and the ACLU and others, they filed this lawsuit against the Department of Justice to demand that the records are unsealed. So what's so important here are a few things, right? The arguments that the government used to try to get Facebook to do this, the arguments that Facebook used to not do this, and the legal reasoning that the judge used in their ruling in this case. I'm in agreement here with the EFF that the government probably argued this under the Wiretap Act with some sort of national security concern mixed in. The thing with the Wiretap Act is that it covers companies that can monitor what's going on over their networks. So, you know, your phone provider and things like that. And a major question that's going to need to be decided is whether the government's arguments were based on the potential for Facebook to decrypt communications on their own network. By default, Facebook can't see the messages that you're sending over its network. However, the question here is whether the federal government can demand Facebook do that under the Wiretap Act or potentially some other legal precedent. So we need to see what the government argued, what Facebook argued in response, and how the judge ruled that they didn't have to do this. It's not enough just to know that the outcome of this case was that Facebook didn't have to do this. We need to know why that was. And frankly, the idea that a legal proceeding in a government court is secret is pretty outrageous.
It's pretty outrageous. Do we know also, and this is a question people ask me all the time, and I have no idea what the answer is, do we know whether or not intelligence services here in the United States have a backdoor into Facebook Messenger? And would that even be a part of this suit, perhaps?
You know, it's possible that it's part of the suit. It's possible that the suit has not been followed up on because there was some other way to do this. There's something called parallel construction in police investigations and law enforcement investigations, where they get some information in a, you know, extra legal manner and then build their case around trying to prove that information or recreate that information in a legal way. But they use what they've gotten illegally in order to guide the rest of their investigation. We know that Facebook works with the NSA. That has been known for a long time. They work with other law enforcement agencies. The question here is whether they could be forced to decrypt to make available to them the content of your Facebook messages. It's very easy for them to say, yes, Chris sent John a message at 12:04 p.m. on Monday the 3rd, and John read it at 12:05 p.m. But the content of the messages is not necessarily available, at least in the legal system as we know it today.
Let's talk about some specific law enforcement issues, too. You flagged, Chris, an article for us saying that Amazon wants to start identifying burglars with facial recognition technology. Tell us about that. I assume this is because so many Amazon packages are stolen from people's front porches, yeah?
You know, that might be one of the things they say, but we should start out by saying this is a patent, right? And patents aren't products, and they're not even necessarily in development, but the whole patent system exists to protect intellectual property, and the entire patent system is extremely flawed. But someone at Amazon was thinking about this, and that someone specifically is a person named Jamie Siminoff, who is the CEO of a smart doorbell company called Ring. And it just so happens that Amazon bought Ring last year and acquired its employees and all of its technology. Ring doorbells include many of them include a camera. So you can actually see via an app on your phone who's at your door. And that actually, you know, that sounds kind of great. Somebody rings your doorbell, you want to see who it is without going to the door. Sure. The problem is, this is terrifying. This patent says that they would compare the images of people walking by or people at your door to a database of so-called suspicious persons. Now, Amazon says in the patent, this would be an opt-in service, but that's an opt-in for the homeowner. That's not an opt-in for a delivery person or you visiting somebody's home or somebody just walking by on the sidewalk. You can't opt into that. It's only an opt-in for the homeowner that has installed this doorbell. This is a private company creating and maintaining a database of what they call suspicious persons. And there would be no legal recourse for people to find out if they're on it, why they're on it, or to get off of it. We know it's hard enough in the U.S. to get off a government watch list or even find out if or why you're on it, something like the no-fly list. This is a private company with absolutely no legal recourse. There's also this major hole in their reasoning here. The patent calls for every homeowner could set up an authorized persons list, and it goes on to say, for example, that like delivery service logos could be whitelisted. So first of all, this is going to be so advanced, or could be so advanced, that it can identify like a FedEx or UPS logo on a t-shirt. But also, like, what would prevent a would-be burglar from finding a FedEx driver shirt at Goodwill and just putting it on?
See, Chris, you gave it away now.
They're going to come after me. Right?
Gave it away. I want to talk about another Amazon story. It's different, and we don't have to focus on it right now, but I was struck about it because I read it this morning on the way to work. Amazon tests its cashierless technology for bigger stores. Online giant tries to overcome challenges caused by retail spaces with higher ceilings, more products. And I'll read a couple of sentences to you, Chris. Amazon.com is testing its cashierless checkout technology for bigger stores, according to people familiar with the matter. If successful, the strategy would further challenge brick-and-mortar retailers racing to make their businesses more convenient. The online retail giant is experimenting with the technology in Seattle in a larger space formatted like a big store. The systems track what shoppers pick from shelves and charges them automatically when they leave a store. Although the technology functions well in its current small store format, it's harder to use in the bigger spaces. It's unclear whether Amazon intends to use the technology for Whole Foods, although that is the most likely application if executives can make it work. Amazon had previously said it had no plans to add the technology to Whole Foods. So you have an app on your phone. You walk in, you register the app as you walk in, you walk around the store, you put stuff in the bag, it automatically charges you, you go out the store, no need for workers. Now, you know, this whole idea that Amazon is helping create jobs, like New York City and Crystal City, Northern Virginia, were bidding to give Amazon so much in the form of subsidy because they would bring jobs to their areas. As our friend and economist Jack Rasmus said in an interview here a couple of weeks ago, Amazon is a job destroyer, not a job creator. I mean, Chris, it seems to me that this is what the working class is facing. Giant corporations that government gives money to, doesn't demand accountability from, but gives subsidies to, decides to just eliminate big parts of the working class in terms of employment.
Yeah, I mean, in a different type of society where people had a right to a job and, you know, we didn't have to be concerned about our privacy and mass surveillance, this would be fantastic, right? Automating checkout, automating stores. But this is going to replace jobs. This is going to put people on the street and into the unemployment lines when jobs are, frankly, harder to find or people have to work. You know, that grocery store job that you have might be one of your two or three jobs just to make ends meet. this technology is fascinating to me, and I've been following it since they started it with their first store in Seattle. And frankly, I think they're being a little coy with this Whole Foods thing. Amazon bought Whole Foods for a reason, and then they started launching these testbed stores in first Seattle, then Chicago, and all over the place. It seems pretty clear to me that this is where that's going, and Whole Foods employees need to be paying attention to this because it could be putting their jobs completely at risk. Because Amazon, again, it's a private company, and we in this society have no right to a job. The privacy issue here also is, how are they tracking you inside and outside the store? There are certainly there have been proven issues with facial recognition technology, which is part of the solution that's in these stores. That facial recognition technology, as it's generally implemented today, is actually kind of racist. It cannot tell people of color apart with the same accuracy that it can tell white people apart. And that's partly because it's primarily white people developing it and testing it. This was an issue on earlier Apple phones that did facial recognition, on Google phones, and in other facial recognition systems, including some used by the Ring doorbell that we talked about earlier, by the way.
Oh, that's so interesting. I own all of those products. I hate to admit it. But I do. And now I'm going to start fearing going home to my own house because my house is spying on me.
Yeah, your house is spying on you.
It's true. Good grief.
Let's go on.
Yeah.
Chris, where are we going? What's next?
We're going to go to an issue with Sennheiser, the headphone maker, and I'm kind of glad I can't afford these. I'm going to get some audiophiles angry at me on Twitter here, but they make, you know, decent, not great, but decent mid to high-end headphones. And I'm kind of glad I can't afford these because, you know, whether this was intentional or not, or just a bad technology or design decision, if you've installed the software that Sennheiser gives you to work with your Bluetooth headphones, you could actually be at risk of all of your internet traffic being intercepted by hackers. It's a very complicated technical situation, but basically they install some software on your computer that can do something called a man-in-the-middle attack, which basically lets somebody else see even your encrypted internet traffic. They can potentially modify it. And the worst part is, if every device had a separate secret key, it would be very difficult for an attacker to do this. Sennheiser didn't use a separate key on all devices. They used the same key that is now widely available on the internet if you know where to look. And that would allow anyone, if an attacker is in a coffee shop and sees somebody with a Sennheiser headset, they can guess that maybe they're going to be able to intercept traffic from their device. Probably not a intentionally malicious thing, but again, private, you know, just putting profits first. They, you know, skimped on the development, or they, you know, or skipped something in their quality assurance in order to get this done.
Speaking of hacks, let's go to the Marriott hack.
Yeah, you know, initially I didn't think this was going to be as big of a deal as it turned out to be. 500 million people are at risk here of having their personal information out there in this, what they're calling a jaw-dropping data breach. This is not just, you know, name and password and stuff, although your name and password are included. This includes stuff like your driver's license, your passport number, your date of birth, anything you would have used to check into or give, reserve a room at a Marriott property. And we should clarify, this is the Starwood branch of Marriott. And you can go to their website. They have set up this, you know, 24/7 call center and a whole thing on their website to see, so you can see what actually was impacted. Credit card numbers actually also may be out there because of a really bad security decision that the Starwood developers made with how they protected them.
It indicated that they may have stored the private keys needed to decrypt payment card information alongside the information itself in an unencrypted format, which, if true, constitutes a major lapse in accepted key management procedures. Senator Ron Wyden is calling for jail time and stiff fines for this conduct by Marriott Hotel. That, I believe, is highly unlikely, but let's talk about it a little bit more.
Well, you know, Ron Wyden, actually earlier, before this even came out, Wyden has released some draft legislation, the Consumer Data Protection Act. And what this would do is executives that have intentionally misled the FTC when they do an investigation on this kind of thing could face up to 20 years in prison. and they could impose up to $5 million of fines on the executives themselves, not just the companies. Now, this all sounds great, and in a just world, this would, that would actually happen, right? And even more, not just $5 million, but the executives have to pay for any damage done to anyone whose information was leaked here. Unfortunately, as we always say, the FTC is relatively toothless. It is a government agency that is, beholden to the corporations. It is not separate from them. And so even if this legislation is passed, which unfortunately I doubt it would be, I hope it will, but I doubt it will be, I don't think we're going to see CEOs going to jail. And I don't think we're going to see $5 million fines being placed on executives, except in cases where they need to make an example out of somebody.
We have 90 seconds left, Chris Garaffa. Let's go to our technology tip for the week.
All right. So this week, the technology tip is what those privacy settings on your social media posts really mean. So in the case of Facebook, you might see there's a little lock icon next to your post, and you can say, okay, this is for the entire world. This is for just my friends. You can actually say, this is for all of my friends except for these certain people. So if you don't want your mom to see that picture of you at a party, you can, in theory, do that. The important thing to keep in mind is that no matter which one you choose, that post is still available to Facebook itself as a company. It's available to advertisers. Facebook's going to use that data. And it's also still available to government entities. So, the NSA and whoever else, the local police, whoever sends a subpoena to Facebook is going to still be able to get that post. So if you need to make a Facebook post that is sort of private, I would consider whether you need to make that post at all. The same goes for Twitter and Instagram and others, where you can lock down your account and only let your followers see your content. Always consider that the company, advertisers, and law enforcement are among your followers.
Exactly. Oh, yes. Okay, we're going to leave it right there. We've been talking with Chris Garaffa in our weekly half-hour segment every Monday called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.